the issue of buying German. We have already seen concerns for people's feelings. We've seen concerns for the feelings of others and so on. We're taking a little bit of a turn now as we talk about the issue of buying, as we'll see, the specific case, the issue of buying German products, but also buying from those who are engaged in wrongdoing now, not those who hurt us mid-century, but those who are actually engaged in hurting others on an ongoing basis, even now. So this is a broad topic. There's a lot to be said, but I think in the next 40 minutes we'll manage to gain some insight into it. Show of hands by those who want to respond, and if you don't want to respond, that's fine. But show of hands by just in general, how many people here, in fact, would not buy a German product? If you don't want to answer, that's fine. People won't interpret a hand being down.
It depends where it was made in Germany.
Got it. Okay, thank you. So that's interesting. It's probably about 30 to 40% of people here, at least, raise their hands to say they would not. Depends on where it's made. There are all sorts of nuances. What if it's not a German brand, but it's made out of German materials? What if it's a BMW versus something else? You know, there are all sorts of different nuances in the way people approach this. I was really surprised by source number one. A study from 2013, University of Manchester. Only 24% of Israelis are ready to purchase products made in Germany. So emerges from one recent study I read at the University of Manchester. I was surprised that the number was that high. Do people not have? Sorry, the sheets? Okay. So, thank you. 24%. I thought that number was high. The reason I thought that number was high is because post-war, Germany paid a great deal in reparations, which we're going to talk about, to Israel. And that included, basically, a lot of money that went into purchasing German goods. Meaning, when they paid reparations, it didn't mean they were giving the government cash. What it meant was the government could then use, it was like a voucher basically, use that amount of money to buy German goods. So you saw Israeli buses that were made in Germany, for example. That's really what happened. So I would have expected that there would be such a great familiarity with German products based on its existence within the society that people, it would have normalized it. That people would actually be more open to purchasing German products. Other people here thought that number was surprisingly low, based on the reactions. Interesting. The truth of the matter is that, you know, I guess you could look at it either way, but that's where the number in fact is, yes. Right, I think that's very true, and not just in terms of being trade partners, but also in terms of being allies on certain political issues. In certain ways, whether it's a product of guilt or something else, Germany has had Israel's back more than various other European countries, you know, over the last couple of decades. Yes?
However, in reading a lot this week for Holocaust education, I didn't realize there are so many survivors who have refused.
Yes, there are quite a few survivors who have refused reparations.
They said they cannot pay.
Right. I'm actually coming to that very shortly. It's a good point.
We're going to.
Definitely. I'm coming to that very shortly. There were a couple of other hands. Yes?
Just was this study from 2013? Like,
yes.
Yes. So yes. I actually think it's very low because we have a new generation. We have a lot of people who moved in from other countries.
Right.
Russians, Ukrainians, the Poles.
That's a whole other discussion. discussion, right? The issue of going to Poland and so forth is its own discussion. There are people who go to Ukraine specifically for Rosh Hashanah because there's a grave of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov there, and other people are revolted. Like, how in the world do you go to Ukraine, you know, providing them with your dollars in order to, yeah, whatever. Longer discussion. Yes, Stephen.
Order of preference. Canada, Israel, UK, Australia, America, and everything else at the bottom.
Okay, you have Stephen's recommendations. So the question then is, well, who's on the list that you don't purchase from? But it's a valid point. There was one other that I was going to take. Yes, Sheila.
You go through the streets and the roads in Israel. There are lots of Volkswagens and Audis and BMWs.
And Mercedes.
Well, again, that goes back to the government making the purchases using reparations. Right. No, that's true. Although there may be some kind of import deal. I don't know.
And also, a lot of Israelis now live in Germany and Poland.
Right. So let me ask the question this way. What are the reasons not to buy German? The obvious... I'm not talking about... What are the reasons today, in 2015, not to buy German?
Honoring the man with your family that died, so you're not going to give them any money. It doesn't matter what they've done since then.
Okay.
The way of you, your own.
Honoring memory of the victim. Okay. Yes.
The companies may still be the same companies like Krupp, who use slave labor. They're a modern company in Germany even now.
So not to support the companies which engaged in this. Granted that all the people who worked for the company are no longer working for the company. Okay, Marilyn.
The original Mercedes were made in the same plant that the gas ovens were. Exactly the same plant, and that always bothers me. And Mercedes are not made there, but they were.
Right. So I think part of it, actually, what Marilyn just said after the point about Mercedes is the key for many of us, which is it bothers us. It's not necessarily a linear thing where, you know, if I buy from them, then, you know, people who did this to my family are now benefiting because the people who are going to benefit now are their grandchildren. Realistically, it's not a linear thing as much as a feeling that this is troublesome. I think there's another issue, and that is that normalization demonstrates forgiveness, or at least forgetting. If I'm going to be okay with buying their car, knife, whatever it is, then it feels like I'm saying that's all in the past now and we've sort of moved on, and that's just... We don't do that. You can't just move on past the extermination of a third of our people. So maybe that's, you know, I think some of the motivation involved. Yes.
Yeah, we can forgive the Germans who killed our parents and grandparents and family. But I lived there for 7.5 years, and I have to think differently. That there's a different generation and a new generation, and at some point you do have to forgive and educate. And I was the first Jew some of them met. And so you can't do that. You know, I'm never going to support Germany because Germany does support Israel. And it has changed.
Right. See, I think the word there that certainly I get stuck on is the word forgive. And I think I would distinguish between forgive and normalize, or whatever other word you want to put on it. The reason I say it is because, number one, I don't have the right to forgive. You know, number two, the people we're talking about, as we've noted, it's a new generation. It's not the people who actually did this. They weren't alive. They didn't contribute to it. And, you know, to blame them for it is odd. And also because the question remains, is commerce, you know, an act of forgiving? Or is it simply a statement of they make the best kitchen knives, and therefore I'm going to buy their product? Yes.
It's a slippery slope. I mean, we thought Switzerland was so wonderful. We've been wearing Swiss watches. They were terrible.
Yeah. This is true. So the question is then, where do you draw the line? Germany, Poland, Ukraine, Switzerland, go on down the list. It's a good question, Sandy. And then
this may be far-fetched, but if we forgive. Almost like saying that any other tragedy is okay.
because it'll be forgiven. And we have lots of evil in our world today that suggests, okay, so we'll do the evil and it'll be forgotten and then we'll move on.
So maybe it's part of holding the line and part of a never again type of a policy. Could be, yes.
Sins of the fathers cannot be put on those of the sons. Is that a Jewish thought?
So the answer is, in brief, that and its opposite are both Jewish thoughts. Meaning that, on the one hand, we are told, Ish b'cheto yumat, the person dies for his own sin only. And then on the other hand, God also says, I will visit the sins upon the third and fourth generation. The Talmud tries to resolve it by saying that where they imitate the sins of their ancestors, then they'll get punished for the whole line, because that shows that this is now embedded in them. Whereas if they make their own way and they put a halt to the practices of the past, then they can't be punished for what happened in the past. That's the Talmud's resolution of it. So the answer is, it is a Jewish thought and it's not simultaneously, but based on the Talmud's understanding, yes, they would side with you and say the descendants are not to be held responsible for what their ancestors did. Yes?
Whether it's fine, the German product,
right, but that's
really what you need to do, or is important.
Right, and many people, I think, have made that decision, have said that this isn't an act of forgiveness. I know plenty of people who are by no means near forgiving, who have gone back to visit, you know, where their parents lived, who have gone back to look after graves, whatever it is. They don't view that as forgiveness. I think once you talk about buying products, there are more people who feel that it is an act of forgiveness, because commerce really does connect people. Commerce is not simply my decision of what I need and this is what I'm going to pay for it. One of the themes we've seen throughout the series, really, has been the connection between the buyer and the seller. It's not simply a financial deal. There's more to it than that. So I want to go a little further because take a look at source number two. This comes from a book which you can see online at Google Books, How to Accept German Reparations. And she writes, my mother, who together with my grandmother survived the Auschwitz concentration camp, long refused to file for reparations, calling it blood money. She was not alone in her views. Many Jews from Israel's community of Holocaust survivors, estimated at a third of the immediate post-war population, refused negotiations with West Germany. Joseph Sprinzak, then the Speaker of Israel's Knesset, maintained, quote, the honor of the Jewish people precluded any acceptance of restitution from Germany, even if it were voluntary and spontaneously offered. There were plenty of people who said not to to accept. And if you take a look at source number three, this is regarding Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was very against accepting reparations. He did not want the Israelis to accept it. He had a conversation with Ben-Gurion about it. And this is a comment that he made in the 80s, looking back. This comment itself is recorded by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. He says, in the midst of privately discussing the propriety of purchasing a German-manufactured automobile, the Rav, that's his term for Rabbi Soloveitchik, displayed one of the innumerous, which isn't the word, facets of his greatness. He said to me that perhaps he had erred when he strongly urged Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion not to accept reparations from the West German government. Israel's politicians and citizens were embroiled in a searing debate in the 1950s about whether to accept compensation from the German government for the Nazi atrocities. In a relatively rare public expression of his views regarding matters of public policy, the Rav at that time expressed his forceful opposition to accepting the proposed reparations. Astonishingly, 30 years later, the Rav said to me that perhaps history had proved him wrong, as the state of Israel would not have developed economically as it had done in the past three decades had it not accepted money from the West Germans. How many older people have the courage and integrity to state upon reflection that they regard a major position that they fought for in years gone by as mistaken? So his highlight, his point is Rabbi Soloveitchik's willingness to step back from it, because it turned out to be crucial for Israel's economic development. Did it or didn't it? You have to ask an economist. I can't speak to that point. But initially, in the 50s, he was very harsh and very strong in his language against accepting reparations. Yeah, Sandy.
One of the tragedies of modern-day Israel is the fact that Holocaust survivors are amongst the most impoverished people in Israel.
Yes.
And I don't know whether it's as a result of not taking reparations to the individual families as opposed to the government. I don't know. But there's been a big push over both, almost getting too late. But over the last number of years, young people have been getting involved in this whole notion of helping Holocaust survivors.
Right, right, and there has been a switch to the individual reparations, which presumably would help them. I have to think that it would. Yes?
There has to be, I think, an understanding of what reparations actually mean. Does it mean if you're accepting the reparations that you're forgiving them? Not necessarily so.
Right.
After the First World War, I mean, that was the reason that Germany fell into such, one of the reasons that Germany fell into such pairs. But the fact is that they were made responsible for paying the reparations for the costs that other countries sustained in the First World War. There was no talk of forgiveness.
Right. So it's an interesting question. Is do you, you know, what is the language that accompanies reparations? And in fact, it was hotly debated in the 1950s. The West German government was not willing to admit guilt and say we are wrong at that stage and have that accompany. They wanted reparations to be viewed as an obligation they are taking on, and that's it. And they were not willing to apologize. That language has changed over the years. But at that point, it wasn't even a question of forgiveness. They weren't asking for forgiveness. But I want you to take a look, please, at source number 4, because this is David Ben-Gurion's response, which I believe is based on the verse that I noted in source number 4. There's a biblical account of a man by the name of Navot, or Navos. Navos was a cousin or nephew of a Jewish king named Ahab. For those who were there when we had the class on Jezebel, so Jezebel's husband was Ahab. And Navos had a great vineyard, and Ahab wanted the vineyard. And he was very upset, very morose. And his wife, Jezebel, sees that he's upset and says to him, "What's wrong, honey?" And he says, "Well, you know, there's this great vineyard." And I approached him and I asked him, I wanted to buy it off of him. I told him I would give him another piece of land, and he's refusing. And she says, "Don't worry, honey, I'll take care of it." And she does. She gets witnesses to, not witnesses, she gets people to claim to be witnesses to a capital crime committed by Navos. She has him executed. And then Ahab gets the field. And so the prophet comes to him and says to him, "Haratzachta v'gam yorashta, have you murdered and also inherited from your victim?" So if you take a look at source number 4, you find what I believe is Ben-Gurion channeling that line, Ben-Gurion being very well versed in Tanakh. He says, the reason why he's accepting this is so that the murderers do not become the heirs as well. Why should they profit from the assets they took, from the slave labor they had? It's not appropriate for them to get to keep all of this, so it's appropriate that the money should instead go to build up the Israeli economy. That was his Tanakh-based response. But I want to move now from what the response was in the 50s to ask how this fits into Jewish tradition in general. We have one case, biblically, of a nation we are told never to forget and never to forgive, but to wage war against through the generations, and that's source number 5, the nation of Amalek. Amalek is the nation that attacks the Jews upon their departure from Egypt. We have harmed nobody. We are not a threat to them. They come along and they attack from behind, and they attack the weak and the vulnerable. And then throughout Tanakh, they continue to wage war against us. At one point, David and his forces are out of the city of Ziklag, and the Amalekites come along and they burn down the city and they take away all the vulnerable people who have been left. They take them away as captives. There's this constant war with Amalek as a theme within Tanakh. And if you look at the verse, remember what Amalek did to you on the road when you left Egypt. He happened upon you on the way and he attacked those of you at the back, the weak behind you. You were tired and exhausted, and he, Amalek, did not fear God. However, it's very difficult to use Amalek as a basis for this. And the reason why it's difficult is because, and we discussed this actually last year when we had our series on war, Amalek really is a case unto itself. It's not something you can extrapolate from to other areas because their evil is unique and because it takes a divine declaration of war against them to create the situation in which there can be no forgiveness and so on. All the other enemies found in Tanakh have the possibility of ultimately making peace with us. Even the Canaanite nations who are encountered when the Jews enter into Israel, we are told, have the option of making peace. So Amalek may be a special case from which you can't extrapolate. A better case is Egypt. They enslaved us for centuries, murdered, abused, and so forth. What was our standing, what was our outlook against Egypt, or our way of dealing with Egypt, post the Exodus? So take a look, please, at source number 6. Rabbi Moses Maimonides quotes us various biblical verses, and he's building off of a passage that's found in the Talmud at the end of the volume called Sukkah. He says, one may dwell anywhere in the world other than Egypt. And he gives you dimensions based on the Talmud, west from the Mediterranean, 400 parasangs by 400 parasangs, opposite Kush, Ethiopia, and the desert. One may not dwell in any of it. In three places, the Torah warned us, warned not to return to Egypt. And he quotes you Deuteronomy, never again shall you return by this path. Another one in Deuteronomy, you will never again see her. And Exodus 14:13, you shall not see them again ever. And this prohibition includes Alexandria, which is a comment he makes because the Talmudic story that he's building on mentions specifically the Jewish community of Alexandria. Yes?
Well, he lived in Egypt.
Yes, I knew that was coming when I put in the line, 12th century Egypt. Maimonides lived in Egypt. Oops. So there are various answers that are suggested to explain what his justification was for living in Egypt. One approach is that he considered himself to be temporarily there. He was hoping to be able to move on. He was working as a doctor for the Sultan, but he was hoping to be able to leave. He had actually visited Israel before going to Egypt, and he had a hope of potentially leaving. That's one answer. Another answer is that he believed this prohibition applied specifically when the original nation of Egypt lived there, because over time populations get shifted, there are migrant populations, and therefore it's no longer the original Egyptian nation that lives there. That's another answer. Another answer is that this only applies at the time when there's a temple. Another answer is that it is that the concern for living in Egypt was specifically that we might learn from their ways. And if the population, in fact, is no longer that original pagan population, then it's not so much of a concern. All sorts of different answers for how it is that Maimonides lived there. But his statement is, don't go back to live in Egypt. Could this be a model for not going back to Germany? Yes, and then Diane.
In many classes that I've taken over the years, these discussions have come up, and it, for various in varying topics. And invariably, someone always raises the issue of, well, what about the Holocaust? And the answer has always been, the Holocaust is a separate case. It's a special case. We don't include that in this discussion. So my question is, you know, is it not a special case here?
Right. And the answer is quite possibly. You're right. In other words, we do look at the Holocaust as a thing unto itself, philosophically, historically, in many different ways. And the answer may well be, even if I can't find a precedent within Jewish tradition, this makes its own precedent. That's entirely possible. I'm looking to see if there is a precedent, because if there is, it makes the argument easier. But you're right. Even if Egypt isn't the model and Amalek isn't the model and so on, nonetheless, the answer may still be, don't do it. True. Diane?
Prior to 1948, there was a thriving Jewish community.
Oh, yes. No, there were Jews in Egypt right into the 50s. And there still are, but not as there were. That's absolutely true. There have been Jewish communities in Egypt all along. I mean, Maimonides is one, but there are other rabbinic figures who lived in Egypt, serious figures, who knew full well about this apparent prohibition. So one way to look at this, and again, in the interest of time, I'm going to stop with the questions on this point because there's so much else that we still need to discuss. I think that Egypt may not be a model as well because there are other reasons to prohibit going back to Egypt besides they were terrible to us and therefore we don't want to be there. If you take a look at source number 7, when the Jews have gotten out of Egypt and they're in the wilderness, at various times they turn to Moses and they say, take us back. Right? We're hungry, we're thirsty, are we there yet? There are all sorts of, that was a joke. There are all sorts of complaints, points at which the Jews say, we wish we had never left. I brought you one example of the hubris in source number 7. When they say to Moses, we recall the fish which we ate in Egypt for free, the cucumbers, the melon, the leek, the onions, and the garlic. And now all we have is this manna that falls from heaven. You didn't eat anything for free in Egypt, folks. It's not called free when you're a slave labor. And in fact, the sages struggle to understand exactly what this complaint was and what are they talking about. But one way to look at the prohibition against returning to Egypt is that it's not about they were terrible to you, therefore you shouldn't go back. Rather, it's for you to return to Egypt as an expression of ingratitude for God taking you out. It's echoing what we just saw in source number 7. That's why you shouldn't go back. Another way to look at it is that the reason for not going back to Egypt is actually political. If you move ahead to the period of the first temple, you find a very interesting battle going on. It's interesting to us because we're not living through it. But there was a battle between the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians. At various times, different nations were involved from that triumvirate. But the Egyptians south and west of Israel, and then north and east you have Assyrians and Babylonians, are at odds with each other. And guess who is in the middle? Us. We're right in the middle. And at various times, the Jews wanted to make an alliance with the Egyptians. And their prophets warned them not to. That God had empowered various nations at various times for his own reasons. He had elevated the Assyrians, then he brought them low, and he elevated the Babylonians. And the Egyptians are not the ones for you to side with. That's one argument. If you're interested in knowing more, take a look, for example, at Jeremiah chapter 42. I didn't bring it here on the sheet. But perhaps the reason not to go back to Egypt is because of the divine plan for where he wants the Jews to go. Maybe it has nothing to do with anger at what they did to us. Another possibility is the one I mentioned before, that maybe it's about learning from their ways. The Egyptians were the symbol of idolatry within the Torah. They're the very symbol of idol worship within the Torah. Maybe that's why we aren't supposed to go back. So they may not be a model either, but I wanted to bring you another model. And that one is much closer to contemporary times, and that is Spain. The expulsion in 1492, and the reaction of the Jewish community to the expulsion. The expulsion was not simply a matter of, okay, you lived here, now you're going to live there. We're talking about deaths, disease, people who lost everything, the uprooting of entire communities, the destruction of Jewish tradition among those who have been in Spain and Portugal. And the expulsion was not only from Spain. We were kicked out of every country in Europe at least once. But theirs was a particularly brutal expulsion. And so there actually was a tradition afterwards, promoted in various communities, of a decree of don't go back to Spain. There was even an alleged curse issued by Don Isaac Abarbanel, leader of the Jewish community in Spain of that time, against the Spanish. However, it's not true. It's not his. It's one of those things that, had it come up in the last 10 years, I would have said it was an internet hoax. But it's an older hoax. It's not an internet-based one. But he didn't actually write that. But there is a tradition of Jewish community saying, never again, we are not going back to Spain. It's not quite clear, though, how exactly this was promulgated. We don't find it, for example, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, even though the Code of Jewish Law is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was himself a victim of the expulsion. one would think that he would have included it in the code of Jewish law if he viewed it, in fact, as law. Don Isaac Abarbanel, who I just mentioned, wrote prolifically in the years after the expulsion. He wrote about the expulsion. He never mentioned any ban against going back to Spain. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, in the beginning of the 20th century, wrote in a letter, someone had asked him about living in Spain. He wrote, "Regarding living in Spain, I have not yet found a clear statement of whether it was a decree or an oath. And the difference between the two is important because if you're going to call it a broad ban, then that means it affects future generations as well. As opposed to an oath by those who were expelled saying we are never going back, but it doesn't necessarily apply to their descendants after them." So he says, I don't know. He says, presumably they were not stricter than the rule regarding living in Egypt, which prohibited only established life and did not prohibit living there for business planning to leave. He notes the temporary character because the person writing to him wanted to know about living in Spain temporarily. So he says, I'm not clear on the nature of this. Rabbi J. David Bleich wrote an article on this in a book called Contemporary Halachic Problems, in which he notes that some have doubted maybe it was only about establishing a Jewish community there, but not about an individual living there. It's very uncertain. We know there was something. If you take a look at source number 9, this is Rabbi Bleich quoting Professor Roth, because I couldn't even find the original article. But Professor Cecil Roth, prominent historian from 20th century, cites religious sanctions imposed upon visitors to Spain and Portugal. These sanctions were incorporated in the regulations of the, quote, Society for Dowering the Brides, Chevra Achnasas Kala, for those who want the Hebrew, promulgated in Leghorn in 1727. In 1785, similar sanctions were included in the Haskamot are agreements, of Congregation Shar HaShamayim of London. Roth states that such sanctions were based upon earlier regulations of the Sephardic communities of Amsterdam and Venice. In other words, almost 300 years after the expulsion, communities still have these bans on the books. Right? 1785, you have sanctions against going back to, even to visit, Spain and Portugal in this congregation in London. It's a Sephardic congregation. And they are maintaining this ban. So, again, the question becomes, maybe indeed we have a precedent for this. Yes?
The Inquisition was actually going on until the 1800s.
Right, that's the...
They would
that. Right, that's true. But the Inquisition and the expulsion are actually separate. Yeah, you're right. The Inquisition, I think, is officially abolished in 1834, 1837, something like that. That's very true. But I don't think it's effective in London at that stage. I think it's primarily in first of all, London being in England, you know, as a Protestant country. Yeah. Right. No, but it's a good point. You're right. Well, if that's true, and if you wanted to then look for a parallel, you could then note that neo-Nazism still exists. So the parallel is there. This issue of living in Spain is a hotly debated issue in terms of what the ban was and how long it was ever meant to last. Some actually suggest that the ban wasn't about hatred for Spain at all. Some suggest it was actually something entirely different. What was going on was there was a decree of the church that anyone living in Spain had to act as a Christian. And therefore, for a Jew to go back to visit would mean he would have to act publicly as a Christian and hide his Jewish identity. And some suggest that that's actually what the bans were about. Don't go back there, because if you go back there, you're going to have to pretend to be a Christian. So maybe that was the issue. So what we have here are three potential precedents. One, Amalek, which I think is hard to apply. Egypt, which is also hard to apply, because there are so many reasons potentially for the ban on going back, and because Jews did go back. Spain, I think, is a stronger model potentially for it. And I brought you two letters addressing the issue. I see we have 5 minutes until 11. I'm hoping we can get through this. But I'm going to say it outside. You can read it inside. Source number 10, Rabbi Meshulam Roth, a major rabbi in the 50s in Israel, was asked this question. There was a proposal in the Council of Rabbis. I don't know who exactly is in the Council of Rabbis he's describing. But there's a proposal before them to declare a ban prohibiting Jews from going back to Germany at all. And he said some of them have agreed with this. And he says there's a lot of merit to the proposal. On the other hand, he says, he doesn't think rabbis have the halachic authority, the authority within Jewish law. And his reason is, first of all, because the general rule is, rabbis post-5th century don't have the ability to issue decrees that will affect the Jewish people as a whole. That's number one. A longer topic, but that's a principle. And number two, it might be considered a decree which the community is not able to bear. It might be a decree that the Jewish community simply can't live by, and the rule is that decrees that are intolerable are invalid. Again, for reasons that require greater discussion. So he says he's not sure it's legal, although he thinks it's a good idea. He's just not sure we have the ability to create it. Contrast that with the Lubavitcher Rebbe in source number 11, who was asked about buying goods from Germany, and the person who asks it apologizes and says, is it a weakness in me for not being willing to buy goods from there? Maybe I should be more forgiving. So he says, no, that's not a weakness, just the opposite. It bespeaks strength of will. And he actually says, and you know, you can go to the link there and see more of his response. But his response is to be supportive of the idea, although he doesn't view it as a requirement. But he is supportive of the idea of saying, I'm not going to purchase German goods. So you definitely see a tide supporting this. And I brought you two cases. There are others. You see, there are those who are supporting this, although they stop short of really declaring it as a Jewish law, because they say, ultimately, as the time goes by, the Lubavitcher Rebbe writes this letter in the 60s. But as time goes by, you look at them and say, well, this really isn't the same nation anymore. And I think that that's what you're going to continue to see, you know, with the passing of decades and the passing of generations, realistically. And this will end up becoming part of the literature, I suspect, of communities that were boycotted at one point or another. The last item that I had here was the question, it wasn't really about Sudan in particular, but the question of buying from countries where the money is going to go to abuse people, is going to go to commit horrific acts. And what I showed you in source number 12 is that we are not allowed to enable evil directly. This is talking about a number 12, selling the Romans bears or lions that they would then use in the arena. They would take prisoners out and have them act as gladiators and get mauled by the bears or the lions. And we don't enable executions, we don't enable wrongdoings. That's principle number one. And number two, in source number 13, you don't buy stolen goods. You don't buy things that are going to strengthen the hand of a thief and enable them to do something further. So if I know, and this is the on one foot statement, but if I am aware that by buying something I am strengthening impropriety, I am enabling people to harm others, yes, it's my obligation not to buy, not to invest in those who would be enabled to commit wrong. Thank you so much. I know that a lot of people had things they wanted to say. I will. Thank you. God willing, I will email out the link later, and please feel free to email me thoughts and additional questions. I will continue to call for topics for the 3-part series, which will be, God willing, November 25th, December 2nd, December 9th. And we'll be in touch by email. And is it 11?
11.
Okay, so we'll have...